Hi, everybody, and welcome to the Cultural Studies Podcast. My name is Toby Miller, and my guest today is
Marwan Crady. I'm a professor of communication at Northwestern University.
And Northwestern University is not in Chicago. It's in Evanston. I keep pointing this out to people.
It's actually most of the campus is in Evanston. There's another campus in Chicago, and there's a campus in Doha where I'm currently located.
Right. So it's true. It's certainly in Illinois, and it's certainly in
Yes.
Qatar. But
Absolutely.
most of it's in Evanston, I think it's fair to say.
Absolutely.
Yeah. And so you're in Doha, and I'm in Madrid. It somehow surprises me we're only an hour apart in time terms. It makes you realize how weird Greenwich Mean Time is as a means
Indeed. Yes.
dividing the world.
It is, and we also Qatar does not do daylight saving, so we're always
Oh,
at the same time.
interesting. So, just to kick us off, Prof, if I may, I wonder if you would share with us what's currently retarding, dynamizing, preoccupying, interesting you.
So, I'll start with what's worrying me. And I think what's worrying me is everything seems to be moving faster than ever before. Now, that may be the complaint of an aging man. I don't know. Maybe we all, we hit a certain time, but I do feel everything is accelerating, the good and the bad, right? So there seems to be velocity preoccupies me, because I believe when you do things too quickly, you don't do them well. Whether it's work, and I don't mean like a sort of a like a Weberian a work ethic of any kind, or what I mean is everything seems to be faster, and when it's faster, the way you react to it, the way you deal with it, seems to be less thoughtful than it could be. Whether it's the proverbial stopping and smelling the flowers or anything like that, I'm clearly worried about the violence that's going on in the world, particularly, but not only here in the Middle East. But I can tell you also what's dynamizing me. I just feel weirdly optimistic. You get into an age where you just feel, the students stay the same age and you don't. And some of the things that our students are doing, there's a real commitment. There's a no bullshit commitment to making the world a better place. And it goes in all kinds of directions. It goes into your traditional research papers. But let me give you a couple of examples. So, you probably hear a lot, including on your podcast, about everybody's obsessed with artificial intelligence.
Yes.
So one of the things we do here is, rather than pontificate about is it bad, is it good, the students ask, what can it do for us? So one of the things we had is a student who created a documentary about the protest movement in Kazakhstan.
Mm-hmm.
That is 100% AI animation. And when I watched it, regardless of what you or me may think about AI, I think our thinking is probably closer, it's clustered around the same concerns, I think. But it was breathtaking, to have somebody do this kind of work. I mean, it was aesthetically haunting. It was politically courageous. And it was intellectually excellent, right? But just watching it. And so that energizes me. And as you know, we're both swimmers. And there's nothing like, one of the best things about living in Doha is that you can swim outdoors 365 days a year. I don't get it to do it every single day because of work, but when I'm in town 5-6 days a week, and it's truly wonderful. And we can talk a little more about swimming, because I've been philosophizing swimming, which may be a pathetic thing to do, but so that's what's energizing me.
You've got to do something while you're plodding up and down the pool. Think,
yes,
it's one of the better exercises for thinking, in my view, other than when things are so crowded that you're worried about bumping into people. Or
yes, and I hate, that's the reason I hate it. Yeah.
people who won't obey, in inverted commas, the rules. You know,
Yes.
these are.
But so here's the fine. Absolutely. So it's great for thinking. It's a very almost hermeneutic process of, particularly if you do, I do a lot of breaststroke because it's less efficient than crawl, right? If you're swimming crawl, I'm going too quick. I don't, it has a different rhythm for me. Maybe it's too fast. So I mix it up. You want to avoid the other swimmers. In my case, every building here, almost every building has a swimming pool. I need to, it's almost, it's like preemptive warfare because there are kids who jump at you just because you're swimming. There are kids who throw things at you. There are groups of adults who somehow meander and end up right where you need to pass. So it's a very changing liquid landscape.
Yes, I sometimes feel that we're confronting John Rawls' veil of ignorance because, in terms of working out what's best for everybody else, we really can't see what we need to do if we're swimming freestyle or crawl because our basic front-on vision is enormously lost. But I'm also
Yes.
thinking about two things. I guess the film The Swimmer with Burt Lancaster, Hollywood film from the 60s, where he hides the fact that I think he's been let go as an executive by obsessively climbing fences and swimming in all the Beverly Hills
Yes.
backyard pools of his friends. And also Marcel Mauss writing about, you know, the lost stroke, one where vast amounts of water are supposedly taken in
Yes. Absolutely.
and then
And you know,
expelled.
I haven't read Marcel Mauss on water, and that's, and I want to thank you for that. I'm going to look it up. But the person whose writing on water has fascinated me is Gaston Bachelard,
Yes.
right? The notion of particularly water versus fire, the what liquidity means, what serenity means, what reverie means, you know, and all those are the things that I was complaining about that make me that make me anxious, which is the acceleration of everything. So almost water is like the master decelerant. You know, you get into the water. I mean, part of it physically, it's not, you don't move as easily as you move in thin air, right? But there's something about it that forces you to think at a different tempo.
Well,
It's always relaxing to think in the water.
you're more supported than is the
Yeah.
case in thin air.
Yeah.
The most reference is quite a small one. I think it's in the Techniques of the Self essay. So you will have read it, but it's very much en passant. The other thing, I guess, is that the reverie elements of swimming are so easily interrupted. If you're swimming in the ocean, a big wave might come, or a jellyfish might sting. If you're swimming in the
Yes.
pool, there might be the mobile obstacles you talked about. So on the one hand, one can be totally lost and totally relaxed. On the other, constantly observant. So the sort of nirvana for many swimmers is either a sort of gentle ocean, quite where you're quite close to the shore, but there aren't many other people, or a genuinely empty pool in the
Yes.
daylight. And
Yeah.
that is spectacular.
So I'll tell you what is most important for me in swimming, which is perhaps self-defeating, and that's visibility. So the most stressful experience on the water, other than one time when I was carried by the current in Acapulco and almost didn't make it back until somebody noticed me and sent a boat after me, was jumping into a very dark cenote in Mexico. And being underwater for, I don't know, 30, 40 seconds, because you know you're jumping from a zip line, and so you're pretty high, so you go deep. I could not see anything. That thing was darkness incarnated, and I was so anxious. I had a panic attack, and by the time I got out, I relished the sun, right? I had another experience here in Doha during the pandemic. You know, the pool, the swimming pool, is a social place, so they don't. You don't want a social place during a pandemic. So I started doing some open sea swimming. And because there's a lot of construction and a lot of sand in the water, you can't see anything. And once I was not too far out, maybe half a mile, and I got bumped by something that was a organic creature, a fish of some kind, that the bump suggested that it was my size.
Wow.
And that meant I just swam while yelling and swallowing water in panic back to shore. It's just there's something about not being able to see when I'm swimming that really, really gets to me.
Yeah, absolutely. And I must admit, I used to swim out half a mile, but now that would be a long way for me to go out.
It does change, doesn't it? It
It
does change.
does. I'm just a, I think in general, and I'm significantly older than you, old friend, I am a somewhat more anxious person, which than I was, which one understands comes with age, but also I am less resilient. I am less resilient when I confront financial, interpersonal, professional setbacks. Whereas in my 30s and 40s, these things didn't really bother me at all.
I couldn't agree more. You know, the best indication is jet lag.
Oh,
I
yeah.
remember in my 20s and 30s, you're flying from the US to London. You
Yeah.
land at 7 a.m. and I would like be meeting people, and you land from 7, you go to Heathrow straight to your first meeting at 9 o'clock for breakfast somewhere. And now I'm demolished. Now I feel you just can't do it. You just can't do it. And nowadays, you know, I have to do some very long trips to go to the Evanston campus. And so I fly to Chicago from Doha. It's about 15 hours. And the only way you can rationalize being in an aluminum tube up a mile or two or three up in the sky for that long is to say, that's my reading and writing retreat. Because otherwise, as you said, you're just less resilience, less, I mean, the back hurts, the knees hurt, the neck hurts, your skin feels like the Kalahari Desert, you know, you can't guzzle enough water. So yes.
Now, I wanted to ask you, moving on to your research, although this is becoming part of your research, the swimming, and has also enabled a lot of your research, because I hope you don't mind my saying you do have back problems, as do I, and that swimming assists one with those problems,
Yes.
at least in our cases. But I wanted to focus on particular issues in your research, which is multivariate. It's methodological, it's theoretical, it's generalized, but a lot of it is to do with Arabic media. And
Yes.
one of the things I was just asked to write about is what are the Americas? And I wondered if you could help me out indirectly, although you could help me with that directly, I know, by telling me what is the Arab world? Because
Yeah, that's
me, a lot
yeah.
of it's in Michigan, and a lot of it's in the United Kingdom, and a lot of it's in France, but
And in Barranquilla and in Merida and in absolutely.
oh, absolutely. You know, it's in Colombia, as you say, it's in Mexico. And that's only starting. We can think of many other places.
So, you know, I mean, these definitions trouble me a great deal as someone who I know I share this with you, and I was partly influenced by you in becoming like this, which is an almost, I don't want to call it an obsession, but a real care for what words mean. Right? So, you know, remember how many conversations, you know, globalization, what does it mean? The Arab world is one of those, like the global South also, which is, I try not to try to figure it out for myself because that's alone a project. And so you can adopt a very minimalist definition, which is basically the countries. There are 2 dozen countries. They're all members of the Arab League of Nations, or League of State, or the Arab League, and they speak Arabic as their official language. To me, this is what it is. Right? Now, of course, once you look a little beyond the extreme simplicity of a one-line definition, it's everywhere and nowhere, right? You have, as you mentioned, Dearborn, Detroit, Brooklyn, areas of Florida. I mean, I will never forget the first time I went to Tallahassee, Florida, with an old professor who, the night we arrived, we went out and had a grilled shark dinner. And I meandered next to the hotel. There was the Tallahassee Cemetery. And I was shocked. You know, I was new to the US. I was shocked by many how many names I recognized as Arab names, Lebanese names, Syrian names, Palestinian names, Egyptian names. And that was my introduction to the notion that it's everywhere, right?
Well, how many thousands of Arabic words are there in Spanish? Or I should say, words derived from the Arabic language. By some counts, it's tens of thousands.
By some counts, it's about 40% of Spanish words derived from Arabic. This is a sore point because, as you know, my partner is Mexican, and I think after many years, you know, it's not funny to be reminded every time a word comes up that, you know, I know the origin. But there are very basic, you know, L is the definite article in Arabic. So I would easily venture that most Spanish words that begin in Al are originally Arabic word. Just like, you know, Arabic is fully grafted with old Ottoman. You know, the Ottomans colonized the Arabs for 500 years. The Arabs were in charge of the Iberic Peninsula for 500. So that's how it goes,
That's how it
right?
goes. Well, one of my colleagues, who's a very distinguished philologist and obviously a native speaker of Spanish, who also speaks, very good English and French, is studying Arabic. And at the level of vocabulary, he's amazed at how easy it is, even though everything else is difficult for her.
Absolutely. It's lovely. The vocabularies, yes, they
And it's
just.
because she has a knowledge of the history of her, in inverted commas, own language, right? Because of that historical knowledge, even terms that have passed away. I mean, a classic Mexican one, as you know, is that we were talking about swimming. I think in the whole of the rest of the Spanish world, the swimming pool is called La Piscina, but in Mexico, it's Alberca.
Alberca.
Just as one instance. And so people who know old Spanish, as it were, who know the history of the language, are very easily mixed in with different uses of Spanish that show different histories of the relationship to Arabic. So,
Absolutely.
yes, but at a very straightforward level, defining these things in spatial terms it makes a lot of sense. And of course, the vast majority of Arabic speakers live in Arab states and so on. I get all of that. But I guess one of the interesting things for me, if you think of someone like Shakira, right, one of the most popular singers in the world, as you know, everywhere in Colombia in particular, where she's from, but the same in Latin America, she's known, as are you, as Lebanese.
Yes,
La
and
Libanais,
this
right?
is what I find so interesting. You know, so it's Shakira in Colombia, it's Salma Hayek in Mexico, right? This is what's so interesting, which is the following. So, I came to the United States on a Lebanese passport, and I was treated, let's just say, very shabbily at airports, at, you know, those the kind of places where you have to show identification. And then 3 years later, I went down to Mexico for the first time. And that's where I went to Puebla. And that's where people were like, wow, you're Lebanese? You know, it was almost a badge of honor. And I had whiplash for like my first 3, 4 days here. What's going on? Until you start looking. So, unlike most places in the world, so if you go to West Africa, the Lebanese have a very bad reputation. In Latin America, they tend to be seen positively, right? So saying La Libanesa or, you know, Lebanese food is very popular in Colombia, in Brazil, Mexico, so on and so forth. So it's seen as an anodyne import. And somehow, in particular, women are seen as, you know, women of Lebanese origin are something very positive, which is not the case everywhere else, right? But also, there's a specific history to that, where when they first moved to Latin America, they were known as Turcos,
Well,
right?
and are still called that generically.
Yes, they're still called. So, and I'll tell you a little more about my visits to Argentina and Mexico to do some work on the telenovelas Turcas, right? There's almost a conflation of anything that closely relates to the Middle East as El Turco or La Turca, right? But somehow the Lebanese, and that's you know, parts of it is good, but it's also a bit of a devious process, particularly for Lebanese Christians, manage to sort of separate themselves from that as a way to get more accepted by the predominantly Catholic societies in Latin America. So that alone is a very interesting sort of a game of inclusion and exclusion that some people in the community played over the years.
And speaking of Turkish television, you've published a lot about that recently, and most of it I haven't been able to read because it's, behind paywalls. But I noted that in The Economist this week, much is made of Turkey being the third biggest television exporter of drama. You know how
Yes.
mysteriously, whenever television exports are described, it's always about drama. It's never about
Yes.
news and current affairs.
Yes. Always.
Sometimes it's about sports, but it's never about the domination of Reuters, of AP, France 24, Deutsche Welle, etc. But putting that to one side, there is Turkey number three, immensely popular in Latin America, as The Economist explains. And also important, I discovered in Sweden, immensely popular in some of the Nordic
Yes.
countries. So, because I've not been able to read much of your work on that, would you mind adumbrating it a bit for us? Because
Sure.
it's such a
So,
big thing. And perhaps we could then talk a little bit about your own other work on the Arab world, but elsewhere too, when it comes to melodrama, novellas, and so forth.
sure. Yeah, I mean, look, one of the so we'll remedy the I'm happy to shoot you a bunch of PDFs. But here's what's fascinating about what you just said. So The Economist uses a British company with numbers that Turkish drama is third because the UK is second, but all Turkish sources say that Turkey is second to the US only. So this alone is interesting. You know, I've never bought the fact that it's absolutely the second in every possible way, and I'm not sure about the third, but the bottom line is, and there are lots of people who have written about this. It's a very popular subject, including some Turkish colleagues who know this a lot better than I do. The bottom line is, there was a moment in the first decade of this century. So sometime between 2004 and 2008, where suddenly the discovery was made that, hey, Turkish drama really plays well outside its boundaries. To me, the big event was a Turkish series called Gümüş, which was translated as Nur. Nur is a female name, but it also means light in Arabic. And it played in the Arab world in the summer of 2008. And in the summer of 2008, I was finishing writing my book on reality TV in the Arab world. And I was in the conclusion, I made sort of a self, like a note to self in a draft of the conclusion, which is, hey, it seems interesting that everything you're saying about reality TV seems to be taken over by Turkish drama. So the empty streets in Riyadh, the capital of Saudi Arabia, when the show is airing, the incredibly impassioned commentary on television in op-eds. There were no social media was not quite a big thing back then, but basically, you know what most would call a total social fact. Everybody's aware of this thing, and it started there, and they never looked back. So, what's interesting about all of this, of course, is that the exports really started big in the Arab world, then moved both into Eastern Europe and Greece. Now, all those countries have a long history with the Ottoman Empire. So there was this very weird dynamic of utter rejection by nationalists and right wingers and, you know, all the blood purist types, but an embrace by a lot of other people, which included young people, but particularly women, middle-aged women. And then the phenomenon spread. It moved to Chile, then Argentina, then went up through Mexico, and Univision and Telemundo and Miami became big pivots for this. And now it's all over the place. You know, Pakistan erects monuments to heroes of Turkish drama, India, right? Everywhere. So to me, the question is, what is behind this phenomenon? Well, as always, one of the things that's behind this phenomenon, and you've written quite a bit about this, is market forces. It's the political economy of drama. If you're a programmer in Argentina and it costs you $80,000 to produce an hour of drama, and you show as a test something that costs you $100,000 for the whole season and it works, you're going to buy more of it. So that's one thing. I think the other issue is the growth of Turkey as sort of a mid-level economic power. I mean, Turkey, again, it's a very large country. It has a lot of it has incredible traditions in literature, in theater, in photography, in cinema that all feed into television drama. But it also had a very booming economy and a government that was very aggressive in both its foreign policy, but also in its foreign trade policy, right? That quickly figured that, hey, we can take a ride on the back of this very popular thing and started offering awards, started facilitating financing for these TV dramas. But then you get to the texts themselves. And this is where what I found to be fascinating. And so I've been, you know, because of my administrative job, because I don't write as much as I used to, it's been very slow. But this is something that has shown up in interviews in Mexico, in Argentina, and in Lebanon. Extremely consistent. And that is middle-aged women who tend to be politically middle of the road, but skewing conservative, who say in Argentina, they explicitly said it, which is Turkish drama in 2020 is like the best Argentinian telenovelas of the 1980s. In Mexico, I interviewed an old woman, a retiree who's in her mid-70s, who was watching one of the Turkish drama, and she started talking about it reminds her of the golden age of the Mexican telenovela. In Lebanon, people said it reminds us of the golden age of Lebanese musalsalat in the 70s and 80s. So when you dig a little deeper, you find a couple of things. One is that, again, there's a decelerated aesthetic. It's not the aesthetic of the action movie. It's the aesthetic of, you know, we're going to take a long pan of the camera over the Bosphorus before we get to the hero's face. So there is an aesthetic element, very high production value, but somehow more relaxed tempo to the production. The bigger thing, however, was the lack of graphic sex and violence. And repeatedly, these women viewers would say, if you watch a Mexican telenovela or an Argentinian telenovela, it's almost like the whole telenovela is an excuse to have five sex scenes and 20 shootings. And people were very explicitly rejecting that. So what I found interesting, it's almost Turkish drama awakened this, I don't want to use fraught language, but almost a conservative silent majority of TV viewers who felt, you know, the dominant genres did not satisfy them, maybe because
Well,
they were aimed at younger viewers.
our friends in Colombia and Mexico, who are not at all politically conservative, don't watch narconovelas because
Absolutely.
they are celebrating violence as a route to affluence for the popular classes, instead of looking at other pathways to affluence or equality. But for our, I think I can speak for both of us. Well, I know I can because of our conversations about this. For our middle class friends, this is anathematic because of the horror of the violence.
Absolutely. I mean, I watched a few of them because I feel I need to know what's going on. But Ute, my partner, who's Mexican, just utterly refuses to watch anything with narco in the title. Precisely
Well,
for this. It glorifies violence as, you know, not only as a means to sort of affluence, but almost spiritual redemption. You know? It's really it's quite remarkable. But so there's a rejection of all of this.
yes.
And you know, some of the Turkish dramas now are a lot more daring, right? I mean, there's one film in the last couple of years that became famous because it showed a live sex scene, right? With some anatomical details. But for the most part, what you see is, I mean, in some of the historic, more traditional Turkish drama, it's like 17 episodes of very furtive looks. And then somebody puts their hand on somebody else. And, you know, another 12 episodes, there's a wedding. It's this complete shift of any kind of attraction or desire to looks. And, you know, melodrama is great with close-ups and, you know, dewy eyes and all that. So it's not my thing, but it's something that is clearly resonating with a lot of viewers everywhere in the world, particularly in countries that can no longer accuse imported television drama of being some kind of a Western conquest. That's the other thing, right? We get into the sort of South to South politics where somehow anything that comes from the South, and it's not just Muslim, Maduro became very famous of showing up at the shooting of Ertugrul, which is this epic, this Turkish biopic about the father of the founder of the Ottoman dynasty, about whom very little actual historical information exists. And Maduro fell in love with the character and apparently showed up at the shooting and donned the hat and the sword. So it resonates in all kinds of ways, right? Because why? Because Ertugrul was fighting the Crusaders and the Mongols, right? Maduro's fighting the gringos. So all kinds of equivalences are made with that.
And one of the things that you've done more generally in your work, Prof, is to look at not only the genres that media analysts traditionally are concerned with, news and current affairs and, in inverted commas, high quality drama, but also very popular drama and reality television. These are things that are often damned in the so-called quality press or are, in inverted commas, guilty pleasures. A little like
Yes.
soap operas used to be in the Anglo world in the 80s. What is the radical potential or actuality of the reality television world, for example, for you?
I'll give you two answers, right? Which is sort of what I read and what I about reality TV worldwide and what I've watched. And the experience of watching, but also researching it in the Arab world. Which is to say that we tend to think of television as something that's incredibly curated and scripted. And even though the claims that reality TV is unscripted are false, there's just a lot of room for somebody to go off script. Why? It's because, Martin Barbero wrote about sort of the time of the family and the time of capital and almost the time of melodrama mediating because between family time and the time of capitalism. One of the most interesting thing about these reality shows is that there is the big show or the big reveal or the big vote on, let's say, Thursday or Friday night. But throughout the week, there's a web stream. In the Arab world, it was mostly a satellite, 24/7 stream of daily life. So it's the glamorization, dramatization, which of course is also a financialization of people's daily lives. But this is not really daily life because they're sequestered physically and they're manipulated in ways to bring out the most sensational performances. So all of that is not clearly a radical potential, but the potential for change comes from when suddenly people go off script. So it allowed in some cases, for example, the expressions of working class concerns that you just don't see on what we call quality TV. You don't see on police series or on Murder, She Wrote or on quality drama, European or US drama, right? So that's one aspect. In the Arab world, what it led to is a lot of questioning. Why are we allowing people to vote for a favorite contestant if we're not allowing to vote for the president of the country? And that, of course, is a very facile thing to say. But once it's a worm that makes its way into public discourse, and then columnists feel compelled to defend themselves against that, to say, lo and behold, no, the king is the king, and this is just a reality show, it just forces the issue into public consciousness. People start talking about it and arguing about it. Now, some people went as far as making connections between the wave of reality TV. Which ended just about a few years before the Arab uprisings and what happened during the Arab uprising. I think that's too far-fetched. But what it did, it made people aware of the potential of certain modalities of talk and activism that otherwise they were not aware of. So for example, that the mobile phone is a pretty interesting thing once it's connected to the web, once it's a quote-unquote smartphone. These are things that developed. So when the Arab uprising actually happened, you had generations of people who were used to using technology for these purposes. But it's always, you know, it's always the people, never actually the technology, right? It's always being aware that you can use, you're supposed to use this for this, to buy things, to watch TV, but you can use it in another way. I think this is the more radical potential.
I wanted to ask you about the Arab uprisings, because there are two lines of flight that have been taken by many analysts in the global north who generalize based on often they're speaking one language, namely English, which is, on the one hand, the notion that the seeds of democracy were sown by the wonderful liberation of Afghanistan and Iraq by the US and its lapdogs. And the other, which I think was more current, is that, and based on English-speaking bloggers who told the New York Times what was happening, English-speaking Arab bloggers who told the New York Times, the Washington Post, and the Guardian what was going on, which is that it was all about new media.
Yeah.
So you have this sort of democracy-centric, global north-centric explanation versus this communication-centric, media-centric explanation.
Yeah.
Now, I know that you were deeply involved with a lot of these debates. I wonder if you could give us your take, casting your mind back on these
sure.
issues.
And that's really like a sort of a walk back. Look, I don't believe there's anyone who, an academic, an intellectual, a journalist who studies the region, who understand Arabic and some of the other languages spoken in the region, in at least in these Arab countries, who would support the notion that the U.S. invasions of Afghanistan and Iraq have helped the democratic movement in the region. Right? So let's just put that to rest. I think what invasions do, particularly when there's no plan for what happens next. Okay, you invade, you break a structure that exists. What happens next? Well, what happened next was horrific, right? What happened next was radical violent movements, was utter social anarchy, was the collapse of institutions like hospitals, like educational institutions, that really plunged these countries. I mean, Iraq used to have some of the very best universities in the Arab world. Iraq had the best national archives in the Arab world, an extremely educated population. And yes, dictatorship undermined a lot of that. But the invasion and the violence and the destruction and the rise of these extreme movements did a lot more. So that's one. I think the second argument, that somehow you throw gadgets into the hands of idiots and the idiots become Jeffersonian advocates for democracy, is, I mean, the evidence doesn't bear that out, right? Which is to say, so I'll give you one example. When I was doing some research in the region, when I went to Cairo during the Arab uprising, on Tahrir Square, you would hear a lot about all these digitally enabled activists who had these, the smartphones and all that. Most of them had the very early first generation mobile phones. Most of them couldn't afford to activate a SIM card, right? And there were some groups of activists who actually smuggled cables from the headquarters of the Arab League, who were just on Tahrir Square, two laptops, right? To be able to connect. So this notion of this hyper-mobile, hyper-connected, fearless activist, it wasn't quite true, right? What studies have shown is a lot of people put their own bodies in harm's way so that a few others could collect images and could come up with slogans, right? So it's a much more complicated picture than you throw a couple of gadgets. And I mean, we've heard what we've heard about Twitter and Facebook, right? In the hands of people, and then political emancipation will happen. That's not true. Did these technologies play a role? Absolutely, they did play a role. Like anything else, like the fountain pen played a role in previous issues, in previous movements, like pamphlets played a role in the French Revolution, right? But to give them this almost human agency of, you know, a little blue bird icon pulling democracy activists in one direction, that's just ridiculous. And as we saw very quickly, you know, what happened to all these movements? They just, reaction took over. And, social media, still that many more people have mobile phones. Many more people have quote unquote smartphones. Things have gotten cheaper. And why is there no political change now? Because it has to do with a geopolitical configuration that's global. It has to do with a political economy that's both regional and national. It has to do with the fact that people want to live, want to survive, want basic food, want basic shelter before they can go on in the public square, brandish a mobile phone, take pictures. This is what's going on.
In amongst that, we also have the example of Iran and a different sort of politics, but one that again is often regarded as connected to the possibilities provided by media technologies of direct contact, direct communication amongst rebellious forces, insurrectionist forces, oppositional forces. What about that situation?
Look, I'll be frankly, so I don't know Farsi, right? So I can read what the major news outlets write about Iran. I do feel it's again, Iran, very large population, very educated population, a very large country that has had a very traumatic relationship with the West since the revolution, right? In the late 70s. But I the thing, the problem is, again, I'm not an expert. I don't know the language. But what I see is similar to the narratives about the Arab world, which is you're young, you're passionate, you have technology on your side, you have the truth on your side, and you want to punch the oppressive regime, the sort of all the, all the sort of oppressive, religiously inflected or performing repression. The problem, of course, with that is two. One is that political regimes in Iran and elsewhere are as adept at using technology as any of the demonstrators or protesters, right? But also that technology doesn't exist in a vacuum. Technology is embedded in a field of power. And who has that power will not only depend on who has a technology or not.
And I appreciate your speaking about not knowing Farsi, because one of the things that we both know all too well is the tendency to extrapolate from one's own language norms to assume a comprehension of all other cultures and how problematic
Absolutely.
that is. We haven't spoken really about Lebanon, and I wanted to ask you about Lebanon, which is where you're from. We've talked about the diaspora, but here is a very small country with a remarkable multicultural, multi-ethnic, multi-religious heritage, one of immense sophistication, one there has been a where there has been a US university since the 19th century, I think. Yeah, American University in Beirut. And one that has been marked by terrible bloodshed and horror from all sides. I wonder what it's like for you as a Lebanese person being back in the Middle East slash Arab world and where Lebanon sits today, because it seems as though it's tragic, as long along with its rich history, its tragic history is also still unfolding.
Absolutely. So, I mean, where Lebanon sits today is it's as a nation state, it's an utter mess. It's a completely collapsed state. There's an economic meltdown. It competes on the highest inflation rate with Argentina and the Congo. It's a very impoverished population. It's economic devastation. It's environmental degradation because garbage is not being processed, because corrupt politicians don't, there's no stewardship, environmental stewardship of the country. And what that creates is a brain drain of anybody who can leave, leaves. And typically the people who can leave tend to be younger. So the neighborhood where my parents live, where in any normal country there would be multiple generations, there are very few representative of my generation. So the people who are the vast majority are people who are in their late 70s and 80s, and some of them early 90s, because everybody else is outside of the country surviving, often to send money to parents and grandparents so they can survive. So it's a very bleak situation. Culturally, Lebanon used to play a special role in the region, alongside Egypt, Iraq, as another example. And nowadays, it's just when institutions collapse, you've had the bankruptcy of one newspaper after the other. The newspapers were not perfect, they were corrupt, they took political bribes and all that, but you did have multiple voices. Television channels are almost all bankrupt and resort to cheap filler, a lot of absolutely inane talk shows. A lot of quote-unquote comedy shows of very low quality, right? So overall, it doesn't look good. Even the model of this coexistence, you don't have real coexistence. You have elites who coexist around their interests, and you have the population who's forced to coexist because they're stuck there, right? So, but generally speaking, what's going on is a move of the center of gravity in terms of culture, media, literature, from places like Lebanon, Egypt, Iraq, to the Gulf states. Why? Because the Gulf states have, and I'm speaking countries like Qatar, like the UAE, like Saudi Arabia, have decided that education and culture were priorities. These are very wealthy states. They tend to be small states. So the institutions that they're building, whether it's public libraries, national libraries, awards and prizes for literature and culture. Not to mention that a lot of people from places where there's war, violence, economic meltdown come here because it's much more stable. So we're seeing a broad realignment in the whole region, where Lebanon is becoming more and more marginal.
Prof, I wonder if I could ask you one more question and then throw it to you to add anything to what we've discussed. You might want to go back over something we've mentioned, or you may wish to introduce new material. Does that sound okay as a way of
That
bringing
sounds
things
great.
to a close? Because I know you have
Yeah.
important appointments ahead of you. So
Thank you.
my last question is to ask you about theory and method. So how do you choose the topics of your research, and how do you know the things you know?
I think you, well, there are a couple of things. I do believe, whatever our trajectory, biography, we can call it a variety of things. We all grow up in a context. And I do believe that for all of us, that shapes what we choose to study. For all of us, academics or intellectuals or scholars. Some of us don't have the luxury to pretend that our life did not affect what we choose to study, right? And some of us are perhaps more open, not because we're better, but because we have to. So that's one thing I wanted to say. I think the second thing is I've noticed a pattern. Well, there are two patterns. That first, you need to hang out with people who, at the very least, if not make you uncomfortable with their ideas or slightly uncomfortable, make you feel you don't know much. People who are well-read, people who are smart, people who are opinionated, and that's very important. I think the last issue I would say is there's a strange way in which you're writing an essay or a book and you conclude it. And this is when you like catch your breath, you relax a little bit, and then you get back. Often, whatever you're going to do next is included in that conclusion, right? For me, I feel I'm very open that my biography did influence what I studied. You know, growing up in Lebanon makes you gravitate towards notion like cultural hybridity, because you can't pretend to be one thing and only one thing. And you have absolutely no illusion about human or cultural purity of any kind. Right? I mean, we in school, we would go to monument. One on one cliff overlooking the Mediterranean is here are the invaders who came here in the last 5 millennia, right? And it's a very long list. So there's no, right? So that's one thing. Clearly, I'm interested in the Arab world because I grew up in it. Because when I was 10 years old, you start having these unlicensed pirate TV channels who would play all kinds of weird things that nobody saw on TV. And I felt that was fascinating, right? So I became interested in it. Later, I've always had a, let's just say, an intellectual fascination with Latin America. But then, I married a Mexican. I started going to Mexico. I absolutely adore everything about Mexico and Mexican culture and Mexican food and Mexican music and all that. And you start thinking, okay, how it's not very instrumental. You start trying to align your life because you have to live your life and you have to do your work. So they may as well be the same thing, right? And so now what I'm interested in theoretically and methodologically is, of course, there's always the what we call the South-South connection. But for me, I'm unabashedly interested in the connections between the Arab world and Spanish-speaking Latin America, right? That's so methodologically, what does that mean? Well, theoretically, it means having to learn Spanish. I didn't grow up knowing Spanish. I learned it because I didn't want to be the fool, the only non-Spanish speaker who was the butt of jokes at a table when people, are drinking tequila and eating tacos and playing dominoes. So I started learning Spanish, and then I started, thanks to people like you, Patrick Murphy, Clemencia Rodriguez, I started reading Spanish scholars first in English. And then I'm like, I'm learning Spanish anyway, I may as well try to read them in Spanish. And that's how it goes, right? So it's a truly it's an interesting convergence of your own personal life and work, right? And then you start reading vocabulary that helps you explain what you're feeling, your experiences, because my experiences growing up were not, I mean, Weber did not tell me much about my experiences, right? Someone like Jesus Martin Barbero told me a lot when I read him. Sort of, there are resonances that don't have to be about language or region. There are resonances of experience. And so one of the things I'm very interested in now is, how do we theorize this sort of transcontinental connection? The connection does exist in migration, it does exist in food, it does exist in yerba mate, it does exist in music, it does exist in figures like Shakira, like Salma Hayek, all that, right? It does exist now in all the kind of resonances that Turkish drama is having in Mexico City,
Yes.
in Buenos Aires, so on and so forth. And I'm beginning to more and more think of everything not as a locus, but as a nexus, right? And I know many people have done very smart work about all of this, but I'm trying to figure out what it means for me in light of my interest in the Arab world in Latin America, right? The other thing that I've done that I feel has helped me a lot is never to buy one theory wholesale and just run with it. But figure out what is it you're trying to explain, right? What is it you're trying to explain? And look at the places where different theories rub against one another. These are the most interesting places, right? And I mean, Innes wrote about this. Perhaps this is why I find Australian scholars and Canadian scholars to be so interesting, right? They're not in London, they're not in New York, but they're close enough. But they're also far. And they've experienced it. They've experienced the good and the bad of the metropolis. So all those mean that, you just, it's not that I'm suspicious of other theories, but smart people say different things. Some of them are helpful to me, some of them are not. I don't feel I need to become a Foucauldian in order to use an important insight from Foucault, for example, right? And I, you know, and I, again, I want to say that I learned a lot of this from you because you're writing about something and you're reading very widely and you're grabbing what helps the argument. You're not trying to hide anything that go against the argument. You're trying to tangle with that, right? But I'm not the kind of person who feels comfortable with a very clearly built conceptual edifice that I stay on for too long.
And lastly, Prof, I'm wondering if there are things, as I said, that you would like to add that we may have touched on or perhaps have not.
No, I think, in general, I wish I had more of these conversations, right? Because it makes you self-aware about all kinds of things. One of the things I try to tell people, if and when they ask me for advice, is to try to find your voice. And this is very, in some sense, it's a very sort of neoliberal thing, you know, your brand, or, but I mean it in a different way, intellectually or academically. You know, when I'm reading a book by Toby Miller, I know it's Toby Miller, even if I don't read the name on the cover after 3 pages. Sometimes it doesn't take that long. There are lots of people with signature voices, but they're very few. There are lots because I can't read all of them. But I feel that's something that I want to end with, in the sense that your own experiences, whatever it is that you read, no matter how unorthodox it is. I've been known, and you do that as well, actually. Maybe that's why I started doing it. Quote some very weird, unorthodox things, you know, that are not typically what scholars quote, because the world is too complicated for us to stick to the canon. And the people who claim to speak against the canon really are vested in creating another canon, right? So this is basically in praise of eclecticism. Of heterodoxy in intellectual work, that I think I worry about this declining as everybody seems to rush around or after one or two big ideas.
Beautifully put, sir. Thank you. Well, it's been wonderful chatting to you as always, Marwan. I want to thank you so much for being so generous with your time. Every moment that I spend reading your work or speaking with you enriches my life, and I'm deeply grateful.
Toby, thank you very much. You know that I feel the same. And I'm very fortunate that you wanted to spend this hour with me.